Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week in Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories in science. Our lead story today... Our lead story today concerns a very gloomy UN report concerning global warming. Unless we heed the message of thousands of scientists, said the United Nations, we're headed for a new normal where sea level rise, gigantic hurricanes, droughts, famines, forest fires, you name it. The Earth is going to be afflicted by these things, but there is a glimmer of hope. The paper also mentioned that if certain measures are taking place now, then perhaps we can blunt the worst effects of global warming by 2050. Well, we'll wait and see. And talking about the weather, the United States had a 1-2 punch in the South, where Hurricane Florence and now Hurricane Michael have created tremendous havoc. Florida, the Carolinas, Georgia, devastated by 100-year hurricanes. Hurricanes that you have to go back into the record to find anything comparable. And yet here we are in hurricane season with, yes, many weeks to go. And perhaps there could be more hurricanes lurking out there. And the question is, well, the obvious one, is there a link to global warming? And then let's talk about outer space. First of all, we had a near disaster in Kazakhstan, where the United States piggybacks on the Soyuz spacecraft in order to send our astronauts to the space station. It turns out that the launch had to be aborted just a few minutes after launch, and the astronauts could have perished. However, the Soyuz spacecraft had a special ejection mechanism, and they were able to parachute back down to Kazakhstan safely. We had two disasters with the space shuttle. 14 astronauts perished. And the question is, do they really have to die? I mean, we saved the astronauts just the other day. But the question is, why didn't we do that for the space shuttle? And speaking about outer space, let's say a few things about new discoveries in the universe. First of all, we now know that there is a Jupiter-sized planet out there called Kepler-1625b. That has a moon going around it. Who would have thought? Not only can we detect extrasolar satellites, we can now detect satellites going around these satellites. That's how accurate our instruments are. And speaking about the solar system, there's more planets and objects out there to be discovered. First of all, there's a new object called the Goblin, discovered during Halloween. The Goblin, which is near Pluto size, lurking out there in the heavens, and that points to the existence of Planet X. So let's talk about a new entry into our solar system. And then the Nobel Prize. The Nobel Prize, of course, has been mainly awarded to men, but hey, in physics and other disciplines, women are catching up. In particular, three people won the Nobel Prize in physics for improvements on the laser, and one of them was Donna Strickland, a woman. And it points to the fact that in the history of the physics Nobel Prizes, this only marks the third woman to win the Nobel Prize in physics. And speaking about physics, Einstein's God Letter is up for sale. That's right. Earlier, it sold for $3 million, a handwritten manuscript of a letter that Einstein wrote concerning his ideas about God and religion. Well, that's big news. Previously, it sold for $3 million. Some people say it will sell for even more when it's up for auction. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. The big story concerns the weather. In South Korea, the United Nations assembled a team of scientists. 90 scientists wrote this report. It was peer-reviewed by 6,000 scientists, and it predicted that in the future, temperatures could rise by 1.5 degrees centigrade by mid-century. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but realize that in the last century, the last 100 years or so, temperatures on average rose 1 degree Celsius around the Earth, and now within a matter of just a few decades, it's going to rise again 1.5 degrees. And this, of course, is going to have substantial effects on the weather. It's going to affect you and me and the economy. First of all, sea level rise. Sea level rise does not necessarily result from the melting of the ice caps. No. Most of the sea level rise is due to the fact that the oceans are warming up. Because the oceans are warming up, hot water expands. And as hot water expands, sea levels rise. And we can measure that very accurately because we know to the millimeter the level of seawater over the past decades. And yes, it turns out that island nations will disappear by 2050. And not only that, but major cities could have to have dikes and levees surrounding them, or else they will go either underwater or gigantic storms will hurl tremendous amounts of water over the dikes, flooding these cities, making them uninhabitable. For example, if you take a look at Manhattan, where I'm taping this conversation, it turns out that Lower Manhattan probably will be underwater in the coming decades, and that's where Wall Street is located. And already there's some talk about building super dikes and levees around Manhattan, or else the economy of a good chunk of the USA could literally go underwater. And speaking about going underwater, the North Polar region is also thawing. Large parts of Canada, Alaska, Siberia are thawing out, and as they thaw out, they release methane gas. Methane gas frozen in the permafrost for tens of thousands of years, and now coming back. In fact, that's one of the reasons why, in science journals, you notice that prehistoric carcasses are being found in Siberia, carcasses of Ice Age mammoths. And why? Because of the fact that they were locked in the permafrost for thousands of years, but the temperature has changed, and therefore they're thawing out. So we're seeing a change in the ecology of the North Polar regions and the South Polar regions. I remember when I was a grad student, people would say that the South Pole, it's as solid as rock. Nothing known to science can cause the South Pole to melt or even crack. Well, it's cracking. It turns out that we see huge chunks of the Larsen ice shelf beginning to break off. Pieces of ice the size of Delaware are breaking off the Antarctic, and this was not supposed to happen for centuries or thousands of years. And then droughts, famine, flooding, forest fires, a new normal could be emerging. And this is something that's going to affect everybody, you, me, at the very minimum. It means that agricultural prices are going to rise because of the fact that foods cannot be grown cheaply because of droughts, famines, and flooding. That's going to affect the bread baskets around the world. Now, we're witnessing essentially a new normal with regards to the weather. New heat waves simultaneously with new flooding, a new normal, 100-year storms, 100-year droughts. That's the new normal. And speaking about that, the United States was hit with a 1-2 punch. Hurricane Florence and Hurricane Michael. In fact, people in the Carolinas were hit twice by these hurricanes. And it's very easy to say, aha, it's global warming. Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. First of all, you cannot say with certainty that any one event is caused by global warming. No, that's not the way the weather works. There's no smoking gun where you can say that this temperature rise was caused by this hurricane. However, what you can say is that on average, you can predict the future. On average, it means, for example, more powerful hurricanes. For example, where does the energy of a hurricane come from? It comes from warm water. And that's exactly what we're seeing now. Temperatures rising in the Caribbean, and that's the fuel that makes gigantic hurricanes. Hurricanes start as a sea breeze off the coast of Africa. And as they go across the Atlantic, they build up more and more energy. And as they hit the Caribbean area and the Gulf, that's the fuel. The hot air is the fuel that makes these gigantic hurricanes that come barreling into Texas and the Louisiana and the Carolinas. And because the temperature on average is rising, it means that you can predict that on average, hurricanes will be more fierce. And this also means more forest fires, more droughts, more famines, you name it. We're talking about extremes in weather. Now, global warming in some sense is a misnomer. The Earth is not heating up uniformly. In one area, you could have a drought. In another area, you could have flooding. And then people laugh at the scientists and say, see, I told you so. Right in the middle of a summer, there could be a cold snap. No, we're talking about an average phenomenon. That yes, all the arrows on average point up. More droughts, more famines, more flooding, more forest fires on average. But you cannot say that any one particular event was caused by global warming. But on average, watch out. Well, let's now turn our attention to outer space. We had a near disaster recently in Kazakhstan. First of all, the United States, President Barack Obama, phased out the space shuttle. Therefore, how do we get access to the International Space Station? We piggyback on the Soyuz spacecraft in Kazakhstan. That's right. That's one glimmer of cooperation between Russia and the United States, which is the space program. Well, we almost had another disaster when the booster rocket failed and they were able to abort the mission and eject the astronauts, saving them, and they parachuted back down to good old terra firma, back to Kazakhstan. What a feat of engineering. Then you have to ask another question. Now, jet pilots have a button, an ejection button, that even traveling at tremendous velocities, they can literally escape the dying jet aircraft. Why can't we do that with rockets? And the answer is, well, we can. So why didn't we? We had 14 brave astronauts, two space shuttles literally explode on national television, exposing the weakness of our space program. And why didn't we have an ejection mechanism? I mean, duh, it's not that difficult. I mean, it costs money, but why didn't we do it? It cost the lives of 14 brave American astronauts. Well, that's what it is, money. It costs money to build this ejection system, and that's the reason why we didn't do that for the space shuttle. Now, physicists have looked back at the space shuttle. Why was it not the gleaming success? It was supposed to be a space taxi, a taxi that would take us into outer space every week, reduce costs, open up a new era of space travel. Well, never happened. Each shuttle launch cost almost $1 billion. Let me repeat that. Almost every space shuttle mission cost $1 billion. That is huge, gobbling up the NASA budget. For science? Not really. We could have shot payloads on single rockets much cheaper than using the space shuttle. So what happened? Well, Freeman Dyson at Princeton says the following. Look at the railroads of the 1800s. As more and more people began to use the railroads, there was a problem. Freight and people don't mix very well, and so the railroad system split in half. One half of the railroad system began to cater to passengers, making cheap, comfortable tickets for the trains. The other half didn't have to be comfortable. It was basically freight, and they specialized in creating a cheap transport system of massive amounts of cargo. So we had a splitting of the railroads, but the problem was the space program never split. The space shuttle was everything for everybody, which eventually meant it was nothing for nobody. In other words, it was part cargo, part astronauts, with tremendous costs. If we would have had rockets just for astronauts, it would have been cheaper, more streamlined, and then, of course, you could haul tremendous cargo missions into outer space with the second system. But unfortunately, the space shuttle became one thing for everybody and therefore one thing for nobody. costs skyrocketed. Instead of being launched once a week, it was launched once every few months. And then we had those two disasters in outer space. What happened there? Well, we think of space travel like a Sunday picnic. We go there for an afternoon and come back a few days later. Ho hum. Television ratings have been dropping steadily. Well, think about it this way. 1% of the time, you go up in space and never come back. That's right. 1% of the time, we have space failures in outer space. We're 60 years into the space age, and we cannot get the failure rate down below 1%. That's just the way it is, folks. There's so many moving parts, so much high-tech machinery, and so much rocket fuel that 1% of the time, rockets blow up or fail. Now, think about it. We've had about 200 space shuttle missions. And how many explosions do we have? Two. So, right on schedule, in some weird sense, right on schedule, the space shuttle blew up on national television, and 14 brave astronauts died in the process, and they didn't have to die. We could have had an ejection system, but we didn't, because of politics, because of costs, and excuse after excuse. You know, when we had the first space shuttle disaster, Richard Feynman, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, looked carefully and isolated the fact that the O-rings of the space shuttle did not function properly when the weather conditions change and temperatures dropped to near freezing. And he demonstrated that on national television. But then, in his report, he did a science experiment. He assembled all the top engineers and bureaucrats of NASA in one room, and he handed out a sheet of paper for each participant in the room. And then he asked each participant, what is the probability of a disaster with the space shuttle? Well, most of the engineers said approximately 1%. That's the failure rate of rockets. I mean, hey, get used to it. 1% of the time, rockets blow up. But one engineer said something totally different. Instead of saying 1%, this engineer said, never. That's right, never. But that, of course, violates the laws of physics and probability. Never, he said. And then Feynman asked himself a simple question. Why? All these engineers were honest. All these engineers, except one, said the probability of failure is about 1%. One engineer said, never. What was different about this engineer? The difference was he got promoted from being just an engineer to becoming a manager, a bureaucrat, and his worldview began to change. Instead of being an engineer looking out for safety, he became a manager looking out for political expediency and cost cutting. And it turns out that Ronald Reagan was supposed to talk to an astronaut in outer space by telephone, marking the success of the space shuttle. And so NASA rushed it. NASA sent that space shuttle into outer space, knowing that the engineers were hesitant because it was cold in Florida and the O-rings would fail. The engineers said, no, don't launch that space shuttle. But the bureaucrats said, well, the president wants a space spectacular. He wants to talk by telephone to outer space, to Christa McAuliffe, the woman astronaut orbiting the planet Earth. That was the game plan. Well, it backfired big time. And it just goes to show you that cost-cutting is one of the least important and most dangerous activities of the space program. Also, we have news from outer space. That's right. First of all, we're going back to the moon. Not only that, but not one, but two moon ships could begin the process of reaching the moon. First, we have the SLS booster rocket, sponsored by NASA itself, scheduled to launch an unmanned probe around the moon at the end of 2019. So write that down. The end of next year, we're going back to the moon in an unmanned capsule. And after that, humans will go into outer space shortly after that. But not to be outdone. We have Elon Musk, who has his own plans independent of NASA. He has built not only the Falcon Heavy, which was successfully test-fired a few months ago, that is a moon rocket fully capable of sending the Dragon capsule around the moon, but he wants to go even beyond that. Now he has a new rocket called the BFR, even bigger than the Falcon Heavy, which can go to the moon, and he's paying for it by himself. This is amazing. Private enterprise. Elon Musk is a billionaire, the billionaire behind PayPal, behind Tesla Motors and SpaceX, and he's selling tickets for the first moon rocket, selling tickets. And we had a buyer, a billionaire, Mr. Maezawa of Japan, a man who made billions creating the Amazon of clothing for the Japanese market, and he bought out the BFR. Now, what does the BFR stand for? Well, B stands for big, R stands for rocket, and F stands for, well, whatever your imagination will take you. So the BFR rocket is very interesting because it's not just a moon rocket. It's actually a Mars rocket. It will be the vehicle that'll take us not just to the moon, but also Mars. And so Elon Musk has a plan independent of NASA to go to the moon and eventually to Mars. Now, the press wanted to know, what does it cost? Well, they're not saying, but Mr. Maezawa bought out the entire capsule, not just one seat. He bought out all the seats on the BFR, and it'll take a few years to perfect. Now, the Falcon Heavy is already ready to go, but Musk wants to go to Mars. And so he's delaying it and creating the BFR that'll go to the moon and eventually to Mars. So we have two different game plans. The game plan of NASA is to create an orbiter, a lunar orbiter that goes around the moon, just like the International Space Station goes around the Earth. And from the orbiter called the Gateway, NASA plans to launch a Mars rocket. Okay, that's plan one. But Elon Musk, not to be outdone, has plan two. His plan is, why bother with the lunar space station? What a waste of money. Why not go directly to the moon in one jump? One jump, beating out NASA by years. It'll take years for NASA to construct the lunar orbiter, but Elon Musk wants to shoot directly to Mars. Well, we'll see how it goes. Many people are saying that the final thing could be a mixture of these two possibilities, because, of course, space travel is not so cheap. Prices have been dropping, of course, but still, it costs a pretty penny to go to Mars, and so perhaps there'll be some kind of compromise between the NASA and the Mars program. And speaking about outer space, new discoveries about our universe. First of all, scientists have been analyzing a planet out there, 8,000 light years from Earth, called Kepler-1625b. It's a rather unusual planet. It's about a Jupiter-sized planet, but it has a moon going around it. That's right, a moon going around a planet 8,000 light years away. That's how accurate our instruments are. I mean, think about it for a moment. Our instruments are so accurate now that we can detect a distant planet going around a star 8,000 light years from Earth, and then detect a moon going around that planet. That's how accurate our instruments are. And it means that the universe is much more weird and much more strange than we thought. Our solar system is the exception. Our solar system looks quite normal. We have circular orbits going around a sun. We now realize that that's the exception. That's the exception to the rule. And so we now know that our solar system is actually the oddball. Speaking about oddballs, new objects are now being discovered in our own backyard, the solar system. First of all, the goblin. That's right. That's the nickname given to it by scientists, discovered around Halloween. And it is a chunk of ice and rock beyond the orbit of Pluto, about the size of Pluto. So we know there are large objects out there in what is called the Kuiper Belt of comets. Now, they're not really planets because they're small, they're mainly icy, and they lie in the Kuiper Belt of comets. So Pluto, sorry to say, is not really a planet in the usual sense of the word. However, if you look at the orbit of the goblin, it wobbles a little bit, meaning that something is tugging on the goblin. And if you use computers to calculate what is causing the gravitational wobbling of the goblin, it seems to be, Planet X. In other words, a new gigantic planet out there. Now, at Caltech, using just computers, they were able to analyze the orbits of these objects, and these small objects in the Kuiper Belt wobble a little bit, and they predicted the existence of a new Neptune-sized planet out there. Now, it was not supposed to be that way. The Kuiper Belt was supposed to consist of comets, small debris, small chunks of ice, the biggest chunk being Pluto. But now we have Planet X. And so, even though we have not observed Planet X, we know of its existence because of the slight perturbations in the orbit of other planets, like Neptune and like the Goblin. And so, our instruments, once again, are so accurate when coupled with computers that we can find all sorts of anomalies in the universe. And speaking about anomalies, one system that is causing a lot of interest, discovered a few years ago, is the TRAPPIST system. Seven, count them, seven Earth-like planets going around a star. Now, it was not supposed to be that way. In our solar system, we just have the Earth, which is Earth-like, which is Earth-size, going around our Sun. Venus and Mars are, quote, outside the Goldilocks zone, where you can have liquid water oceans. Well, it turns out that in the TRAPPIST system, we have seven Earth-sized planets. It wasn't supposed to be that way. And of the seven, three appear to be planets that are sized just right, that they could, in fact, harbor life. And speaking about life, the holy grail of all of this is to find a doppelganger, a twin of the Earth in outer space. So far, we haven't done that. But already we have a handful of very likely candidates that resemble the Earth but are a little bit too big. However, it's now believed that because we find so many planets and because we have a new orbiter out there looking for them called TESS, TESS may one day find the holy grail of astronomy, and that is a twin of the Earth in outer space. And then we'll ask another question. Who lives on that twin? Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. In the second part of Exploration, we're going to rerun an interview with a noted climatologist talking about the effects of what happens. What happens if global warming gets out of control? What happens if the worst fears of the UN report are realized? What happens when sea levels begin to rise, when cities become inundated? What happens to the human race when the weather goes amok? That's what we're going to talk about in the second half of Exploration as a Wake-Up Call. And if you want a copy of today's show, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. He's Professor David Archer, Professor of Geophysical Sciences at the University of Chicago, and he's the author of a rather disturbing new book. And it's called The Long Thaw, How Humans Are Changing the Next 100,000 Years of Earth's Climate. He argues in The Long Thaw that not only are humans ruining the atmosphere of the Earth by dumping copious quantities of carbon dioxide, but the effects of this will linger in the atmosphere, not just for years, not just for centuries, but 100,000 years. And what does it mean?
What does it mean for us to live in a world with that much carbon dioxide and that much global warming? So once again, the special guest is Dr. David Archer of the University of Chicago. The book is called The Long Thaw. Professor Archer, as a youth, how did you first get interested in science, and in particular, earth science?
I guess I looked to the earth, the functioning of the earth, the stable geochemical cycles of things like that, as something that's bigger than people are. I look to the natural world with a sort of reverence, and I think that's what brought me into the natural sciences, why I chose to study the oceans, actually, instead of forests or other planets or stars or something like that, is because I've always had a romantic love of boats, but now I ended up living in Chicago anyway, but that's just one of life's jokes, I guess.
Okay, well, let's get right into it. First of all, what is the relationship between carbon dioxide and global warming?
Well, carbon dioxide traps infrared light that tries to leave the atmosphere. It's like if you put a coat on in the wintertime, it traps some of the heat leaving your body, and so it allows your body to warm up. And the theory about CO2, how it affects the climate of the Earth and how much it affects the climate of the Earth, is over 100 years old now. It's very, very solid science. If there were no greenhouse effect, we wouldn't be able to explain why the Earth isn't in a deep freeze, or the climate of Venus, or lots of other things. It's very solid science.
And, well, talking about Venus, some people call Venus the greenhouse planet. Why would a carbon dioxide atmosphere for Venus make it the greenhouse planet?
Well, there's 70 atmospheres of CO2 in the atmosphere of Venus, so it's very, very thick greenhouse forcing. It has a very strong greenhouse effect. Actually, Venus is also a very reflective planet. That's why it's so bright in the night sky. So if there were no greenhouse effect on either Earth or Mars, even though Venus is closer to the sun, it would be colder than the Earth because it reflects away so much of the sunlight that would heat it up.
Okay, well, now let me play devil's advocate. Some people say, bah, humbug. The current warming of the Earth is a natural cycle. The Earth is naturally warming up. Other people say that it's the sun. Yeah, the sun. The sun is causing the Earth to rise in temperature, not human activity. And other people say that the Earth is cooling. What are your thoughts?
Sometimes it's even the same people who one year say the Earth is not warming up and the next year say that it's warming up, but it's entirely natural. You know, ours is a contentious species. We tend to take both sides of positions, even if there's nothing to base assertions on. If they sound good, they still can carry some weight. The Earth has clearly been getting warmer. That's measured, even though it's been a cool summer here in Chicago. Overall, the average temperature of the Earth is rising. The sun has not been getting brighter. We have good measurements of the intensity of the sun from satellites going back a few decades, I don't know exactly, but it's not, there's a sunspot cycle that makes the sun brighter and cooler over 11 years, but there isn't a long-term trend at all in the sun getting brighter. So, you know, people say what they, you know, think people want to hear, and people hear what they want to hear, but there is, you know, objective reality. We can measure these things and say what's really going on.
Okay. Well, some of the critics say, okay, so maybe the Earth is getting warmer. However, human activity, some people would say, no, it's not human activity. So what's the reason that many scientists believe that it's human activity causing the current warming?
We can estimate how much warming to expect from rising CO2 concentrations in the air. That's actually boiled down into a number called the climate sensitivity, which is how much the climate would warm if you doubled the CO2 concentration. And the first estimate of the climate sensitivity of the Earth actually goes back to Svante Arrhenius in the year 1896, over 100 years ago, who predicted that doubling CO2 should raise the temperature of the Earth by about 6 degrees centigrade, and now they say it's something like 2.5 to 5 degrees centigrade. It's really not that much of a change. It, 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 it's a tricky calculation because it's very complex the way that CO2 interacts with light. But this is, by sort of normal non-political rules of science, this is a done question.
So if you, let's say, were to remove humanity from the planet Earth, then you're saying that the Earth would not be so warm as it is today?
There was a model exercise conducted by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So these are climate models developed all over the world. And they all subjected their models to one scenario where you tell the models about the rising concentrations of greenhouse gases, and then another scenario where you only have the natural climate forcings like the intensity of the sun or volcanic eruptions can cool down the planet. And if you tell the models about the greenhouse gases, they can explain the warming that has been detected since sort of the 1970s. The warming, the temperature since the 1970s, that's the smoking gun for global warming. If you don't tell the models about the greenhouse gases, they don't warm up in the same way. So if you want to say that the warming is real, but it's caused by, you know, something that we don't understand in the climate system, which, you know, there will always be things that we don't understand, not only would you like to come up with an explanation of what that something would be in order to settle the question, but you would also have to figure out why the CO2 is not causing the warming that we attribute it to. It's sort of like if you catch, I make an analogy in my classes to a murder mystery, because people always put on their thinking caps when they're reading murder mysteries. They don't always put on thinking caps when they're thinking about science. But so you catch the butler with the gun in his hand and the dead guy, and there's, you know, smoke coming out of the gun, and your partner is sort of a contrarian guy. You're a policeman trying to you know, solve the crime. Your partner says, well, I think the chauffeur did it. But, you know, for your partner to convict the chauffeur, he's first going to have to explain to the jury what the butler was doing with the smoking gun in his hand. In other words, translating back out of the analogy, if we want to say that the warming is not from CO2, we have to explain what's wrong with greenhouse theory, that the CO2 should not be causing the warming.
Well, if you look at temperature rises over the last many centuries, you see a gradual warming, because after all, there was an ice age 10,000 years ago. But some scientists say that there's a spike that is quite anomalous that is taking place in the last 100 years, and that's proof that it's human activity because it's not part of the natural cycle. What are your thoughts?
Well, there is this large-scale glacial-interglacial cycle that you refer to. There's also a sort of a milder, much shorter, I don't know if it's a cycle or just sort of fluctuations, but back sort of between the 1300s and the 1700s was a time of generally cool temperatures called the Little Ice Age. So you could, you know, ice skate in Amsterdam and things like that that you no longer can do. And that is correlated with a lack of sunspots, which indicates that the sun was cooler. We don't have satellite solar intensity data going back to the 1600s, but we have observations of a number of sunspots that date back to, you know, Galileo's invention of the telescope in the 1600s, and there's a correlation between the number of sunspots and those sorts of climate changes. I think the evolution of climate up until the 70s, though, can be explained pretty well by natural forcings. It isn't until the 70s that the climate signal started to, the human-forced climate signal started to come up out of the noise of natural variability.
Now, also, some people say that the last decade was perhaps the hottest decade ever recorded. How far back does that go? Because, of course, perhaps during the dinosaur era, things were a lot warmer back then.
Sure. So there are thermometer records that go back to about 1860 from Fahrenheit's invention of the thermometer. They can piece together the temperature of the Earth going back further than that with what they call proxy records of temperature from the widths of tree rings or from chemical measurements they can make in ice cores or sediment cores or something like that. And so they can record, they can figure out that the Little Ice Age was cooler, and then there was a period of general warmth before that called the medieval optimum climate. Those records generally go back 1,000 or 2,000 years, and the conclusion of the last IPCC report, which summarized climate, you know, for non-specialists and for, you know, for the community outside of your own field, very useful, very, very authoritative reports. They concluded that current temperatures are warmer than they have been in 1,300 years. But if you go back millions of years, you're absolutely right. Peaking about 50 million years ago, the Earth was it felt tropical to the poles, and there was no ice anywhere to be found. And this is thought to be due to higher CO2 levels in the atmosphere at that time. We don't have as good ways of estimating what the CO2 concentration was when you go that far back in time, but the evidence that has been pieced together is all consistent, that there's sort of million-year or tens of million-year fluctuations in the natural CO2 levels of the Earth that sort of drifts up and down like that.
Now, scientists that have gone to the poles to extract ice cores, essentially getting ice that was deposited perhaps several hundred thousand years ago to maybe a million years ago,
yes,
they see that carbon dioxide levels and temperature levels go up and down in unison like two roller coasters. What does that mean?
It's rare that you find such beautiful correlations in nature, I think. It's just astonishing. Al Gore showed this plot in his movie. That's sort of how iconic it is. It's an astonishing thing.
So, Professor Archer, ice core data shows that carbon dioxide levels go up and down.
But the temperature of the Earth goes up and down, and the two of them go up and down like two synchronized roller coasters. So what does that mean if the ups and downs of carbon dioxide exactly mirror the ups and downs of temperatures on the Earth?
Somehow, the orbit of the Earth around the sun has these wobbles in it, and that is thought to pace the progress of the ice age cycle, when the ice sheets are going to grow or when they're going to collapse. But somehow, the CO2 concentration of the air follows along with the changes in the climate, so that when the orbit tells the ice sheet to make the Earth warmer, the CO2 says, okay, I can pitch in some to that too, and so it amplifies these climate changes.
So which comes first? The temperature rise comes first and then the carbon dioxide rise, vice versa? What's the relationship?
It's a back and forth cause and effect. It's a feedback system. So to ask which one is driving which, I think, is like asking if you see two figure skaters, you know, twirling each other around on the ice, you know, which to try to analyze the trajectory of one without paying attention to the other would make no sense. On the deglaciation, the transition from the ice age climate to the present day climate, the first thing that started to happen, as recorded in the Antarctic ice cores, is a change in temperature in Antarctica. And then a few centuries later, the CO2 concentration started to rise. But then the total change in climate took much longer than a few centuries. So there's no way you could explain the climate transition from the glacial world to the interglacial world without taking into account the change in the CO2 concentration. So it's a feedback loop of cause and effect. It isn't just one or the other drives the thing.
So summarizing, if you were to go back 10,000 years, we had the Ice Age. Things have been warming up in the last 10,000 years. But is it safe to say that recently, in the last several decades, there's been a spike in temperature rise, and that's due to human activity?
That's more or less true. Actually, the interglacial period is called the Holocene, and the early Holocene, right at about 10,000 to 6 or 8,000 years ago, may have been warmer than today. The Earth's orbit around the sun was in a different, you know, slightly different configuration than it is today. So it almost seemed like there was a peak in warming and then maybe a little bit of gradual decline driven by the Earth's orbit over the millennia. But certainly over the last 1,000 years or two, the temperatures of the last decade are anomalously high.
Okay, let's talk about the present. What's happening with glaciers and the North Pole and the South Pole? We see evidence of the melting of the glaciers around the Earth. That's why scientists are finding so many mammoth bones and even human remains, because the glaciers are receding. So what evidence do we have that the Earth is warming?
Well, we just have the thermometers. I mean, for direct measurements of temperature, thermometers are hard to beat. But the mountain glaciers are almost all melting. It's difficult for a glaciology graduate student to find an advancing mountain glacier to study anymore because there are very few that exist. There's warming detected in the deep ocean. Fairly deep, not all the way to the bottom of the ocean, but you can see the warmth sort of penetrating the ocean. In the high latitudes, the Arctic is melting like crazy. It's the sea ice covering the Arctic Ocean is melting much faster than any of the models a few years ago predicted. The year 2007 was a sort of a train wreck for the sea ice up there. It just plummeted. Actually, in the southern hemisphere, it's not so clear what's going on. In the interior of Antarctica, it actually is cooling, which is not, that's something that the climate models also predict. So that's not a discrepancy. But there's also not been a melt back in the sea ice in the Antarctic either. And I gather there's still some messiness about that issue, that maybe it's caused by changes in the circulation of the atmosphere caused by the ozone hole, which is a completely different sort of phenomenon. Ozone is a greenhouse gas, but it also absorbs ultraviolet light, and so it heats up the air that it's in the stratosphere. That's why the stratosphere gets warmer as you go higher up in the stratosphere because of ozone. So by wiping out the ozone in the spring of the Antarctic every year, that changes the dynamics of the air, and maybe that's responsible for a lack of global warming signature generally in the southern hemisphere. Actually, there has been very intense warming on the Antarctic Peninsula, which kind of sticks out from Antarctica up into the slightly lower latitudes. And so you read sometimes in the newspapers about these ice shelves, very thick floating shelves of ice, hundreds of meters thick. You could walk on it and not know that you weren't on solid land, that suddenly have been collapsing. Places that have been covered by ice for, you know, since the last ice age, suddenly are ice free. So there are signs of the climate change every place. The growing seasons have gotten longer. The Arbor Day Foundation has published maps of climate zones of where you should plant begonias or tulips or whatever, and those have changed since 1990. There are all kinds of signs. It's more obvious in some parts of the world than others. Actually, in Chicago, there hasn't been much climate change since the 70s, but if you go up to Alaska, the climate changes have been huge. So, you know, local experience is not necessarily a good guide, but you put it together into a global average, and it's very clear.
And also, you mentioned how it affects plants and also animals with the changing of the growing season, but also insects, right? Some people are saying that the West Nile virus, which has been spreading through urban centers, is in part driven by global warming, and then in the future, malaria could also spread. What are your thoughts?
I'm not a public health person. I don't really know a lot about the details of this, but people that I talk to are very concerned about the effects of climate on public health. I think the World Health Organization estimated last year that there are 150,000 deaths a year that can be attributed to climate change. Now, obviously, that's a, you know, statistical sort of question that's not so easy to answer. But the people that I talk to say that's a very realistic. They have models of disease transmission and everything, and the climate and the insect vectors that carry the diseases are part of those models. Now, that being said, you can do a lot about malaria itself just with you know, mosquito nets and you know, insecticides and things like that. And so I have heard the argument that instead of paying to reduce CO2 emissions, we should just pay for mosquito nets. I don't think the tropical diseases are the main reason why we want to worry about changing the climate.
Okay, now let's talk about the thrust of your book, which talks about the future, up to 100,000 years into the future. Well, first of all, let's talk about the coming decades. What's happening with the temperature on the Earth? Projections out to 50 years, 100 years. Some people say that on a scale of decades, major metropolitan cities like New Orleans, Boston, New York, San Francisco could be partially underwater. So what are the projections for, let's say, 50 to 100 years?
Well, one of the big uncertainties there is what we do with CO2 emissions and energy, but you can take as a baseline just to talk about what they call a business as usual scenario, which is a projection of how much energy people will need and how much fuel they will burn to get it if there were no constraint from changing climate. And the temperature changes responding to that would put the Earth warmer than it has been in millions of years. So saying what exactly the impacts of that would be on, you know, the corn harvest in Iowa or something like that is really not a very easy thing to do. With respect to sea level, the question is all how quickly can the major ice sheets respond to the changes in climate? The models that have been developed in the past don't respond nearly as strongly as the observations that glaciologists actually can make in Greenland and Antarctica about how the ice streams flowing into the ocean respond to the changes in climate. You can measure more ice quakes in Greenland with seismometers than you could 5 years ago. And the ice sheets, the ice streams flowing from the ice sheets into the ocean are accelerating. So it's really kind of anybody's guess how long it takes for sea level to change. There were events in the past called Heinrich events when the Laurentide ice sheet, which was in North America, every 8,000 years or so during the last ice age would just collapse into the ocean. And there would be this armada of icebergs in the North Atlantic, and they would carry little rocks and sand and stuff like that that would then deposit on the seafloor, and there's no way for those to get there other than these icebergs. And so that's how we know about these events today, is by finding those layers of rocks on the bottom of the Atlantic. Those seemed like they took a century or a few centuries, and they seem, some of them, to have raised sea level by many meters, which is much more than any of the ice sheet models predict for the global warming climate event. But I think most everybody thinks that these ice sheet models are just lacking some essential physics at this point.
Well, some people say that the real problem with sea level rise is simply the thermal expansion of ocean water with the rising temperature of the Earth. And since the Earth is rising in temperature, the oceans are going to expand no matter what happens to the North Pole or the South Pole.
Well, that's absolutely true, and that's part of the forecast for sea level rise by the year 2100, which is about a half a meter or so. Something like half of that sea level rise is caused by exactly this effect, the expansion of the seawater. It's like the mercury in the thermometer that fills up more of the thermometer when the temperature goes up. That's a process that will keep going for centuries. So the forecast for the year 2100 is not sort of the end of the line, that's sort of just the beginning for the thermal expansion of seawater. The other half of the sea level rise that's actually in the IPCC forecast for the year 2100 is melting of smaller mountain glaciers like in the Andes and the Alps. And actually, a lot of the sea level rise today can be attributed to mountain glaciers in the state of Alaska. It just happens to be a place where there's lots of ice frozen on mountains and where the climate changes are very intense, but it's some astonishingly large fraction of the sea level rise comes from Alaska.
Okay,
just as a curiosity.
Okay, so what does that mean for the average person who has to make decisions, enormous decisions, in the next few years about fossil fuel consumption, about investment in solar energy, and so on and so forth? What changes in their lifestyle should we expect in the coming decades?
Well, you know, lifestyles could change because we adapt to new energy technologies. Most of the CO2 emissions that can be avoided in the next few decades actually come from improvements in efficiency.
Well, unfortunately, that's it for Exploration. Once again, we had two special guests today. The first special guest was Dr. Peter Ward, author of the book Flooded Earth. And the second guest was Dr. David Archer, author of the book The Long Haul. And this is Exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku. And if you want to get a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Once again, for a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Good day.